jffradio.org.
This is Radio Catskill with the weather. An air quality alert from the New York State DEC continues until midnight for all of upstate New York. An air quality index greater than 100 is unhealthy for sensitive groups, and that includes children and those with pre-existing respiratory problems. Smoke and haze continue tonight, reducing visibility at times. The overnight low, 64. Highs in the low 80s tomorrow, and chance of continuing smoke and haze. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.
Good evening and welcome back to a new episode of Virtual Soundscapes, the video game music show only on Radio Catskill. I'm your host, Matt Hurtado. Have you ever wondered what the first video game was? Did you know that it was a direct result of the creation of the atomic bomb? Tonight we'll find the answers, as at the end of the program we'll interview Dr. James Ivory from Virginia Tech about the history of video games. And in celebration of the history of gaming, let's listen to some music from video games about history, starting us off with Charge of the Knights from Crusader Kings III. That was the main theme from Age of Empires 4, winner of the best strategy game of the year at Dice 25. Before that was Things Worth Living For from Kingdom Come Deliverance, a Polish video game often cited to be the most historically accurate video game ever made. Next up, let's dive into some music of the realms of feudal Japan and listen to some tracks from Ghost of Tsushima, a personal video game favorite of mine. This is Sacrifice of Tradition.
Thank you. Thank you.
We just heard Eternal Blue Sky and The Battle for Iki Island from Sucker Punch Productions to Ghost of Tsushima, a game praised for its historical accuracy to feudal Japan and winner of multiple Game of the Year awards in 2020. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll listen to some more great music from history-driven games and then talk with Dr. James Ivory at Virginia Tech about the history of video games themselves.
Public health policies are changing fast.
Turmoil and controversy continue today at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
New dietary guidelines.
A major overhaul to vaccine recommendations for children.
At NPR, we're committed to bringing you the science behind the headlines. I'm public health reporter Ping Huang. Support NPR science coverage by giving to the station today. Thanks.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Virtual Soundscapes, the video game music show only on Radio Catskill. I'm your host, Matt Hurtado, and tonight we're going back in time and listening to some of the best music from video games about history. At the end of the segment, we'll also interview Dr. James Ivory from Virginia Tech about the history of video games themselves. But let's first listen to A Brief History of Everything, a song from Europa Universalis 4.
Thank you.
That was Buckingham Palace and Inn Taverns and Great Halls from Victoria 2 and UE4, two hyper-realistic strategy simulation games focusing on the history of Europe and the UK from Paradox Studios. Now let's take a break from the music and have a chat with Dr. James Ivory from Virginia Tech to discuss the history of video games themselves. You're listening to Virtual Soundscapes on WJFF Radio Catskill. I'm your host, Matt Hurtado, and this is the third episode of our video game history segment. Today I'm joined by Dr. James Ivory, professor of media studies at Virginia Tech and author of Virtual Lives, a reference handbook which describes the history, development, and role of virtual worlds and their societal impact. Dr. Ivory, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So, Doctor, can you tell me about your work at the VT Gamer Lab and background with studying the history of interactive media and video games?
Yeah, I suppose I've had a really lucky life where I've kind of stumbled into the chance to study things like video games all the time. I had a background where I was initially planning to be a journalist. I got a college degree in journalism, and then in grad school in communication, I kind of stumbled into the idea of thinking we should sort of study more about what people are doing with video games at that time in the field of communication. And even in psychology, there wasn't as much research as there is now. So kind of began to do behavioral research on video games, mostly remembering being a kid and finding them fascinating at times and thinking that, you know, there's something worth studying there. A few decades later, I've got a lab here where we do behavioral research. Don't make a lot of things. Sometimes you work with people that do, but mostly just study what happens with people in video games, how people interact with each other in them, and, you know, just kind of human elements of video games in general.
And I noticed that the Virginia Tech Gamer Lab, Gamer is an acronym. Can you tell me what that stands for?
So I'm always thinking about rebranding it. I'm not a legendary brand person, but as I suppose an academic wouldn't be. But originally, we've been calling it the Gaming and Media Effects Laboratory, the kind of media effects tradition in communication and to a lesser extent in psychology is kind of a longstanding one. I'm actually thinking about kind of renaming that to be more around media experiences, because I think media effects sort of implies kind of a one-directional like sort of dosage that affects people. And I think that doesn't really describe people's experiences with video games more as much as it used to. We used to do a lot of studying things like, you know, does violent content affect people, or even like a different controller interface affect people? And we still study some similar things. But as I realize we're studying more and more like what people do with each other in games, effects probably isn't the right word, but a little more long answer than you wanted. But yeah, traditionally, it's been the Gaming and Media Effects Research Laboratory, and we're probably going to rebrand that as my thinking about what people do in games evolves.
So I read your paper, A Brief History on Video Games, and they have a pretty interesting point of origination. Can you talk about the industry that games first came from and who was responsible for creating the real first video game?
Yeah, I think the tricky part about studying video games, especially when you're talking about like what is the impact of video games on a person's life or how do people use them? It's tricky because there's not really one thing that is a video game. You know, I think that's the case with media in general. You know, what we know what a book is, but there are certainly very different ones. But with a video game, you know, we don't really even have concrete agreement on sort of what are the defining characteristics of a video game. So they sort of have kind of different evolutions from different things related to computing. I would say arguably if you're talking about the first game that uses some sort of electronics and an actual video display rather than just an electronic game that doesn't have video, a pretty good claimant for the title of first video game is actually a sort of not even a prototype, kind of a novelty that somebody in a research lab that was about other things created for Visitor's Day. called Tennis for Two, a guy named Wally Higginbotham, who worked on much bigger projects. And on Visitor's Day, he would use an oscilloscope, which is certainly not something you'd think of as visual game equipment now, to create sort of a tennis-type game that people could play. And to my knowledge, it was just taken apart afterwards. But it's got a pretty good claim to the first video game in that it had a video display and used some, interfaces and things like that. There are some games that were electronic in some way in nature, like chess type games before that, but they didn't have a video display. So Higginbotham and his thing that he did to keep visitors busy when they're wandering around looking at much more important but maybe less interesting things, I think lays claim to maybe the first game.
So that game came out, I mean, the game, like you said, quote, end quote, came out in 1858, which is almost 70 years ago.
Well, came out's a strong word. Just imagine, you know, a guy whipping something together in a lab that's never going to exist again. But yeah, it's been a while.
And, you know, I mean, obviously it took a lot longer than 1958 for us to start seeing things like the Atari and Commodore, Magnavox Odyssey, all of that. But why did it take so long for video games to be recognized sort of on the same level as film and art as a legitimate form of media?
Yeah, I think you got a couple things going on there. When we sort of started seeing people figure out that they could commercialize this, it took a little while. And then once it was commercialized, it has taken far longer to have the same sort of respect or even identity in people's minds that other media forms do. I would argue we might still be waiting for that to happen. But the earliest prototypes of video games, just like Higginbotham's, mostly involved people working with brand new technology for other purposes and just kind of creating novelties. A more widespread game in the 60s that came out was on the first sort of personal sized computers, but at this point really only existed in research labs. So you're talking about graduate students and undergraduate students in sort of the red hot universities and the red hot what would become computer science programs messing around with them. I don't think anybody really thought of these novelties originally as something that could be commercialized. And then as the 60s poke along and into the 70s, people start figuring out people having so much fun with this, maybe we can make a little money off it. So we don't really see it commercialized till the end of the 60s and the 70s at all. As far as turning video games into, you know, something in the public consciousness that's viewed as an art form, I think the people who grew up around them, the people that video games are important in their life, that's probably always been in the case. Pong and Pac-Man and things like that, they're aware that there's more to it than just pixels floating around. And for people that are unfamiliar, they still don't believe so. So I think the idea of video games as a legitimate art form is kind of in the eye of the beholder. And I don't think we've won over people who don't play video games yet. Roger Ebert famously said, you know, that video games will never be legit like art does. I think he's sort of changed his mind towards the end of his life. And I don't hold that attitude against him. I think you're not going to end up using any of this because I'm just going on and on. I'm sorry. Let me get back to focus. But
no, it's great.
When it comes to looking at video games as a legitimate art form, I think the users of them have been on board for a long time. I couldn't tell you how long. It probably has to do with when narratives could be legitimately communicated through video games rather than just one dot going back and forth. I think for critics or for people unfamiliar, that's still not happening. Like I said, Roger Ebert famously said video games, you know, weren't the sort of art form that movies are. He caught a lot of criticism. He was very good natured about it. And I think eventually sort of changed his mind a bit, partly because I think he realized that if there are people who feel like this about video games, that sort of makes them an art form. I think there's other milestones along the way. We see some old court cases about video games where there's discussion about, is this even something copyrightable? As in, is there any expression here, or is it just a machine with a patent? And then we see those court cases start to evolve more and more into not only is this copyrightable, but does it have full free speech protections and things like that? So I really hate to slice your argument too thin, even though that's probably what my job as an academic is. But the whole idea of kind of when is it a legitimate art form, it might depend on how you're looking at it. Do you mean from a legal perspective? Do you mean from a cultural perspective? Do you mean commercially? And I think all of those have different answers.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, you've written a lot about how video games have influenced kind of social narratives and cultural discussion. So that was the impact I was going for there. Why do you think that they, and how do you think that they're so impactful today as part of our culture and our social narrative and the way that we interact with one another?
Yeah, and I think when we talk about sort of the impact of video games over not just the course of their history, but even over the course of a life, it changes as time goes on. Like you said, in some form, video games are getting closer and closer to being a century old. So they've changed a lot, you know, the graphical realism, the kind of processing, being able to play with other people online, all things like that have changed what video games are. And that doesn't just happen over the history of the medium. It happens over the history of a person's life. I wouldn't say I was like the biggest aficionado of video games ever when I was a kid, but I certainly found them fascinating when a friend would have some or something. But it was a very different medium then for me. It's sort of a lot of times almost a complex puzzle or an action task. And, you know, now I see my children interacting with games that are much more stories and with characters that I think they anthropomorphize a lot more. I don't remember really having a specific video game character who I related to. And, in my kids' generation, I see that. And so I think even over the course of a lifetime, video games mean different things to people as they evolve because it's a different medium. This might be forcing the analogy a little, and it might be trying to make it a little bit profound, but it's, a little bit like growing up with a child where they're the same person all the time, but you're also kind of meeting a new person as they get older and mature and their personality changes. I've got kids and I think about it a lot that way. I look at my kids and I say, this kid's the same kid they were when they were a year old. But then I also say this kid's really different than they were a couple of years ago. And it's really cool to get to know this new person too. And I know I'm probably trying to make that sound a little more profound than it is, but video games, I think, can be a little bit that way. Like even whether it's someone who was born in the 70s, whether it's somebody who's born in the 2000s, the video games have evolved sort of as they've grown up. And I think what video games meant to them as a child is different than what they might be to them as a teenager or as an adult. And it's not just because the person's changed, but because this is a medium that actively changes in your lifetime. I don't think all other media are like that. Yeah, film, technology, special effects get better, but it's kind of the same structure. This is an interesting medium in that it's extremely different by the time somebody's an adult than it was when they're a child. And I wouldn't say that's necessarily the case with something like a book or a movie.
Dr. Avery, thank you so much for joining me tonight. If people want to find out more about Virginia Tech and your work, where can they look?
We've got a lab website under the Institute for Creativity, Art, and Technology, which is an absolutely amazing institute here at Virginia Tech that allows us to look at multidisciplinary things like video games. We've got a site under that. People can contact me directly. My email address is jivory@vt.edu. If you want to be a little more annoyed, you can still reach me on what used to be Twitter. The history of video games and what they mean is complex. I don't think my answers have been very straightforward, and I apologize, but it's a tricky history.
That's a wrap on this historical-themed episode of Virtual Soundscapes. I've been your host, Matt Hurtado. Tune in next week for another great hour of video game music. If you'd like to hear the interview with Dr. Ivory again or any of our previous guests, you can find them online at wjffradio.org/podcasts. On Spotify, or in the Silicon Valley Archives at library.stanford.edu. Playing us out right now is Mongolia, the Medieval Era, from Sid Meier's Civilization IV. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
it's a new era for public media. We are still here and we're in this together. So let's get to work. Donate to this station today and thank you.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Catskill with the weather. An air quality alert from New York State DEC continues until midnight for all of upstate New York. An air quality index greater than 100 is unhealthy for sensitive groups, and that includes children and those with pre-existing respiratory problems. Smoke and haze continue tonight, reducing visibility at times. The overnight low, 64. Highs in the low 80s tomorrow, and chance of continuing smoke and haze. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.